This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on August the 30th, 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's Thursday, August 30th, 2012, and we're live in Studio One here in London. I'm Tyler Brulé. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, the Syrian delegation walks out of the non-aligned movement summit after Egyptian President Morsi describes the Syrian government as oppressive. We'll be discussing the fallout, if any. And while things might be heating up off the coast of West Africa after a recent pirate attack, they might be cooling down off the coast of Somalia. Is it safe to go back in the water?
The actions of the navies against the pirate motherships by which they have been intercepting them and disarming them before they can get into a position where they pose a threat to merchant vessels.
And in aviation, Philippine Airlines made everyone smile at Airbus earlier this week with a whopping order to upgrade their fleet. Will China keep them grinning in Toulouse and Hamburg? Murdo Morrison from Flight Global will be here with more. And we'll also be talking to Edward Skidelsky, co-author of the book How Much Is Enough, about the perils of having it all or too much. And Hugo MacDonald is just back from the Biennale in Venice with his official verdict. What is it?
Well, I'll be telling you about the highs and lows of Venice later on. And if you're lucky, I'll be playing you some noises by Sir Norman Foster too.
We cannot wait. All that ahead here on Midori House, live from Midori House, right here in London on Monocle 24. And without further ado, over to Jonathan Wheatley with the hour's headlines.
Monocle 24 News. Mitt Romney faces a critical test in his White House bid when he addresses the Republican National Convention in Tampa today. It'll be his biggest television audience to date, as much of the nation will tune in for their first extended look at the 65-year-old former Massachusetts governor who unsuccessfully sought the Republican nomination back in 2008. Romney, who can often come across as stiff, faces the challenge of making Americans feel more comfortable with him. Well, Carl Downey, a spokesman for the Republican National Committee, said the stage had been reconfigured to convey a more intimate feel.
We've expanded the podium, we brought it out and lowered it, so, you know, give the sense that, you know, of something that much more intimate, that much more personal, and, you know, bring Mitt Romney down into the audience, essentially, and, you know, viewers at home are going to see a different stage, different podium, and, you know, it's cool, it's exciting.
The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has criticized Iran, who are hosting the Non-Aligned Movement Summit, which is being held today in Tehran, for threatening to destroy Israel and for denying that the Holocaust ever happened.
I strongly reject threats by any member state to destroy another, or outrageous attempts to deny historical facts such as the Holocaust. Claiming that another UN member state, Israel, does not have the right to exist, or describing it in racist terms, is not only utterly wrong, but undermines the very principles we have all pledged to uphold.
Libya's newly elected National Assembly has suspended three members for having links with former leader Muammar Gaddafi's government. Nasser Ben Nour, member of the Assembly's High Organization for Transparency and Nationalism, said the suspensions of the three Assembly members from different cities had resulted from evidence and documents the organization had found. About 1,000 supporters of the former president of the Maldives, Mohamed Nasheed, have poured into the streets of the capital, Male, today in protest at an internationally backed report which said the leader's removal early this year did not constitute a coup. The Commonwealth-backed report is a blow for Nasheed, who'd hoped to return to power. Demonstrators streamed towards the normally peaceful main square of Male, shouting that they wanted new elections now.
Because the security was so low, but we don't want to make any problems. That's why we are making peaceful demonstration. Thanks to Anni, who gave us this right and who tell us that we have some right in the country.
Australia's Finance Minister Penny Wong has today spoken in Moscow about some of the issues the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC, ministers will be addressing at an upcoming summit in Vladivostok in Russia. She said many at the APEC summit would be focusing on the Eurozone economic crisis.
Well, I think everybody is well aware of the risk that Europe and the situation in Europe poses to the global economy. I think we've all seen that. So obviously we would encourage the Europeans to continue with their path of reform and to lay out a sensible, clear path so that governments and markets understand very clearly what the reform path is.
And finally, if the French King Louis XVI needed a computer, he might well have turned to a company based today outside Paris, proud manufacturers of gold-plated flat-screen models with a marble base and a leather-clad keyboard which can set you back €17,000 or more. The firm has for several years been serving the technological needs of the great and good with a series of computers which would not look out of place on the writing desks of Versailles. The computers come in three principal styles, Louis XV, Louis XVI and Empire, and are built using luxury materials using marble and semi-precious blue stone for the bases and bronze and brass for the monitors plated with gold leaf. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Jonathan. Just what we need in the studio, I think, no?
I think you'd like one.
Yeah, I would absolutely love one. I think it's time for this Acer sitting on our table here to go anyway.
Gold-plated would be great for you, I think.
Orders will be going in for the Christmas party, just you wait. We have two papers, just front pages, just in one from, we've got the press in from New Zealand. And it's actually quite an interesting front page story that they're talking about, of course, the ongoing story of the reconstruction of Christchurch after the earthquakes, and it talks about a couple, it says Littleton pair told design not suitable, and they show this cantilevered affair which really looks like almost a pair of shipping containers on stilts, quite progressive, something that might work in other cities, but it seems that the local council is not at all happy. Also another story is talking about coastal walkways would regenerate suburbs, and the notion if they built a walkway from Mount Pleasant to Sumner would be a great idea to also regenerate earthquake hit neighborhoods. Also, just for youngsters preparing for the weekend in New Zealand, MPs vote to keep alcohol at age 18. Sydney Morning Herald, a rather more grim cover this morning, says five Australian soldiers have been killed, the most in a 24-hour period since the Vietnam War, and that dominates pretty much two-thirds of the front page of the Friday edition of the Sydney Morning Herald. You are listening to I was going to say the briefing, but that was a few hours ago. You're listening to Midori House. It's 1807 London. We're back after this.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 talagat, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e io cosa?
Tama on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. Well, earlier today, the Syrian delegation walked out of the Non-Aligned Movement summit in Tehran after Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi described the Syrian government in his speech as oppressive. Well, with the situation in Syria in a continual spiral, does Syria's exit from the conference hall really matter? And what might have been achieved had they stuck it out? Well, we're joined on the line now from Beirut by the Washington Post correspondent, Babak Degambise. Hello, Babak.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. I guess maybe just why don't we frame the Non-Aligned Movement Summit? I mean, what were they hoping to achieve, not just vis-a-vis Syria, but even in a broader context?
Sure. Well, this Non-Aligned Movement Summit is really a showcase event for the Iranian leaders. You know, it really is pretty much the biggest diplomatic event that they've hosted since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. And more importantly, you know, in recent years, considering the you know, the diplomatic effort to isolate Iran, to pressure them over their nuclear program, this was meant to show that the country still does have ties with a lot of different countries, and you know, that they're not quite as isolated and kind of left alone as the U.S. or other Western countries would like them to be.
And where did events in Syria sit on the agenda? Was this really an anchor piece for the summit, or on the other side, as you're saying, it was really more about Iran's role in the world, and of course, they happen to have a little bit of sway in Syria?
Sure. Well, for you know, Iran is the biggest regional ally or biggest ally, period, for the Syrian regime at the moment. So for them, I think the key was to downplay or practically not even mention the unrest and the conflict and the killing happening in Syria. So I think when Mr. Morsi stepped up today and really opened the summit by going right to the heart of the matter and being very critical and calling for the countries to stand up against what he called an oppressive regime, I think that was quite a direct snub and quite an unexpected thing for the Iranian leaders.
And where has it left the hosts now? I mean, with Egypt out of the room, of course, another serious regional player. How does it leave everyone else in Tehran who have to be looking after? I'd imagine at this point, a big summit dinner and everything else. You know, where does the agenda move now?
It seems that they basically chose to ignore it. They dealt with it by not dealing with it. Even the live translation of the event, which was broadcast on state TV, the translator stumbled, and then the audio was cut out. So, the Iranian leaders are very sensitive about the message that they send out on Syria. Obviously, the message that the Iranian officials and the state media like to send out is pretty much, in lockstep with what the regime in Damascus is putting out these days, which is that the regime is being threatened by, foreign-supported terrorists and so on. So for, a world leader like Mr. Morsi to come out there and really kind of put an entirely different view of what's going on and call for support against an oppressive regime, again, I think that was very embarrassing for Iranian leaders, and I'm not sure they quite knew how to handle that.
Who else flew in? If we went to Khomeini Airport and we looked at the tarmac, what other countries' aircraft are lined up?
Well, I think you're seeing dozens and dozens of leaders, everything from smaller African nations, to larger nations, very prominent nations like India. But I think the Mr. Morsi definitely was one of the leaders that the Iranian officials were very happy to receive. Iran's relations with Egypt, with Mr. Morsi's predecessor, with Mr. Mubarak, were not good, particularly because of the Mubarak regime did have diplomatic ties to Israel. So, to get Mr. Morsi there was a big achievement in their view. And also to have Ban Ki-moon, to have the UN Secretary General there in Tehran, was also in their eyes a big event. And Mr. Along the same lines as Mr. Morsi, Mr. Ban Ki-moon also went off script and criticized Iran, particularly on their denial of the Holocaust. Mr. Ahmadinejad, the Iranian president's denial of the Holocaust, and also kind of urged them to be more transparent about their nuclear program.
And do we know what happened to the translator at that point?
That part I didn't catch. I'm not sure, but I would imagine the audio went kind of indiscreetly offline again.
Do you think the ambitions of the Secretary General, also those attending from India as well, that, let's call them breakout sessions if that's what they are, that there's a lot of parallel diplomacy going on, that people are hoping that they can use a softly approach with other non-aligned members there, and again, one has to sort of wonder, how much does everyone have to toe the line in and around the host nation?
Right. Well, I think in this particular case, I mean, the meeting, in my view, has, the non-aligned movement is not seen as particularly effective in terms of their what they are able to achieve. It's largely a symbolic kind of meeting and organization at this point. I'm sure, though, that as you mentioned, that the meetings between various countries, it probably was a good forum for that kind of ties. But I think in this specific case with, the Iran being the host, the baggage that comes with Iran and, all the things going on with Iran at the moment really did overshadow the events of the meeting itself in a way.
Great. Babak Diambise in Beirut from the Washington Post. Thanks very much for that. You are listening to Midori House. It's just 13 minutes after the hour here in London. And when we come back, we're going to be talking piracy. And you are back in Studio One here at Midori House. Well, the number of piracy incidents in the waters off the Horn of Africa have dropped rather sharply over the course of 2012 so far. According to the United States, last week showed only 46 pirate attacks in the area compared with 222 last year and 239 in 2010. Well, that's up to last week, that is. Earlier today, our news editor, Tom Edwards, spoke to Potengal Mukundan, International Maritime Chief, about the reasons the numbers are down.
We think the reasons for this are threefold. The first one is the actions of the navies against the pirate motherships by which they have been intercepting them and disarming them before they can get into a position where they pose a threat to merchant vessels. The second reason is the use of private armed security by the ships themselves, and this has prevented many of the pirates being able to get close or board these vessels to hijack them. And the third one is the use of best management practices by the vessels themselves in hardening the ships and resisting any attempts by the pirates to get close to the vessels or pose a threat. So these three factors, all three of them together, have resulted in the reduction in the attacks in the last 12 months.
Now, I understand that there's obviously some seasonal variation at particular times of year, or depending on whether there's monsoon weather or not, that can have quite a direct impact on the instances of piracy attacks of this sort. Is this just a statistical anomaly? Could it just be down to weather, or are you're convinced that it is down to those three main factors?
We are not really looking at the attacks during the monsoon periods. Monsoons take place from the first week in June until the end of August, and also in December and January. These are typically the periods when they happen. When the weather is so rough that the small boats, which is used by the pirates to board the ships, attack the ships, cannot put out to sea. And what we are looking at are figures, you know, of the attacks right through from the beginning of the year till, for example, now. And it allows for seasonal variations.
Now, I wanted to ask you about the sort of second factor that you cited in your first answer about private armed security on board ships. Obviously, that's been quite a controversial development. Are there any real negatives to that? I know that sometimes some ships have trouble, for example, entering port in certain areas because they won't allow armed security on board. Is that an issue? Is that causing an economic problem?
No, it's not so much an economic problem. The issue is a legal one. I mean, armed teams are used by ships because owners and crews see no other way to properly protect their vessels when they are out at sea and far away from help from the naval vessels which may be in the region. And the difficulties for owners in doing this is that the laws are not completely clear as to whether or not they can have these armed teams on board, how the armed teams get the weapons on board the ship, because they have to come from a coastal state, and coastal states don't all agree to allow weapons to be transported through their territory. And of course, there are issues of the rules of force under which the private armed security opens fire on a boat which is getting close to the ship, and what governs that and what rules govern it. So these are the issues which the UN body, the International Maritime Organization, has been grappling with in the past year or so.
I wanted to ask you about another aspect of this, and that is obviously a number of these pirates were based traditionally in Somalia, and there was clearly a political instability there and a lack of governance and accountability that made it a lot easier for pirates to, for example, launch raids from there. Is there any evidence that increased security on the ground in those port areas within Somalia itself has also contributed to this decline in attacks?
We don't think so. And the reason for this is that the pirates are primarily operating along the coast of South Central Somalia, which remains a lawless area. There is very little effective regional government, law enforcement agencies, judicial agencies there, which are operating. And this is what gives the pirates the opportunity to go and hijack large vessels 1,000 nautical miles away, bring them back into this coast, anchor them and keep them there with impunity for 6 to 8 months whilst they negotiate a ransom for the release of the vessel. It could not happen anywhere else in the world. And this coastal strip is still as lawless as it was before. It hasn't changed. But there are areas in the north around where the governance has improved. But I don't think that has a direct relevance on the reduction of piracy in this area.
And Potengo, just finally, I wanted to ask you about your thoughts looking towards the future. Would you expect to see more instances of armed security, for example, wider instances of that, perhaps even more heavily armed people and more of them? Or are there any other key sort of developments you'd like to see to, you know, ensure that piracy has even less of an impact on international shipping?
Well, we'd certainly like to see the Somali piracy come down or be eliminated altogether. The reason is that we have not spoken yet about the human cost of piracy on the seafarers who are traumatized by their experience as captives under these pirates for 6 to 8 months. And many have died in captivity, and some of them have lost their confidence and are unable really to work at sea again. So these are the real problems with piracy. So we'd like to see a decline in these attacks altogether or a complete reduction. But how we go about it, I think if actions can be taken ashore in Somalia, but along the coastal strip in Somalia where it is desperately needed to build commerce, build employment, it will deny the pirates the safe haven from which they are operating at the moment. I think that is really the key.
And that was Potengal Mukundan, director of the International Maritime Bureau. He was talking to our news editor, Tom Edwards. It's just 20 minutes after the hour of 1800 here in London. We're going away for a short break. A few tunes when we come back.
No food, no battle. Monocle Films attends Kitchen Boot Camp to witness operational excellence in the field of the culinary arts.
We really try to provide to the last moment fresh food to our troopers. While other armies, they start quickly to eat out of tins and they just are distributing survival packages or bags where you add some hot water. We really try to serve good, healthy food based on fresh products, even on the front line.
You can watch this film and many more from affairs to business, culture to design in the programs menu on monocle.com.
Inspirational mayors, money-making gentrifiers, park creators, subway planners, tech hub upstarts, wayfinding geniuses, broom-toting road sweepers, stadium designers, all-seeing historians, and squawking birds. If they help make a city, you'll meet them on The Urbanist, Monocle's weekly show about the cities we live in that's presented by me, Andrew Tuck.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here in London. It's a 2022, if you're listening in Thailand, 1922 in Brussels. It's 1822 here in London. Time for a song. I will take it back another time zone, though. Let's go up to Sweden. And this is Mira. Swedish spin on Bossa Nova. That was Mira with At 17. You're listening to Midori House. Back in a moment.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24. This
is Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are back at Midori House in Studio One with me, Tyler Brulé. Well, it's Thursday. It's almost every day is Aviation Day here on Monocle 24. And we always love checking in with Murdo Morrison of Flight Global. He is on the line now. Murdo, it started off as a fantastic week for Airbus with this announcement that Philippine Airlines at long last is going to upgrade their fleet in the face of competition from the likes of Cebu, etc. But it also might be good news for Toulouse and Hamburg as well with an order from China as well.
Yeah, good evening, Tyler. This is great news for Airbus again this week. It's been a real bumper week for the European manufacturer, and they've secured an order for 50 A320s, and that's 30 of the current model of the A320, and 20 of what are called the NEOs, the new engine option A320s, which will come on stream from 2015-2016. Another piece of good news for Airbus. And really, there's no stopping Airbus at the moment. They really are having a very, very successful year.
Do you think there's, I guess one can never feel smug when you're sitting in the CEO's office, either at Boeing or Airbus, particularly after we saw the cancellation last week of those 787-9s at Qantas, because I guess cancellations can also hit Airbus at any time as well.
They can, yes. And, the global financial situation is still precarious, even in the boom regions of China and Asia. There are possible looming problems with the economy slowing down and so on. So, orders are one thing, as airline manufacturer bosses are keen to say. It's revenues, it's deliveries that matter much more than orders, because orders, while they're a great signpost for what's coming, and obviously there's long lead times between these orders and when the aircraft are actually delivered, the manufacturer, Airbus or Boeing, really only gets the bulk of the revenue when the aircraft leaves the factory and enters service with the airline. So a lot can happen, although deposits and everything are paid, a lot can happen between order and delivery.
Are there any, from China's perspective, are there any vested interests in also placing an order with Airbus? We've seen Bombardier, we've seen Embraer, all dipping into the market with joint ventures or assembly contracts of various scales. Is there any upside for the Chinese aircraft industry in also placing orders with Airbus?
Yes, there is. Of course, there is. And these orders of these magnitude are always going to be political, because in a world where there are only two manufacturers of large aircraft and only a handful of manufacturers of smaller aircraft, these things are something that governments and presidents and prime ministers care about very much. So there's always these sort of deals going on. But of course, it's a mutual thing. It's very much in the manufacturer's interests to work with the supply chain in China as well, not just because it will help them secure orders, but because there's some very, very good technology in China. It's still a relatively cheap, low cost market, outsourcing work there, getting Chinese industry involved in the supply chain, it's more than just a tactic to oil the wheels of commerce and make sure that you're selling some aircraft.
Murdo, much was made around the time of the launch and even the run-up to the launch of Boeing 787 about the use of carbon fiber in the aircraft, and really that this was a big collaboration, not just on the part of Boeing and its regular suppliers, but really it was also seen as a big collaboration between USA Incorporated and Japan Incorporated, Kawasaki, Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, Fuji, all playing a huge part in really getting the 787 off the ground. Do you think we move to that type of place in China, perhaps not in the next 3 or 4 years, but if you were to look a decade out, that you would have recognizable Chinese engineering companies, supplying complete wing parts, fuselages, etc.?
Yeah, I think that's very, very likely, and it's a combination of both the investment and the engineering that the Western manufacturers are prepared to share with China, but also the huge amount of investment that China itself is putting in its into R&D and education and really developing its own very, very skilled engineers. I mean, these guys are coming out of, I forget what the statistics are, but there are a frightening amount of, well, frightening, depending on what whose perspective you're looking at it, but a huge amount of aerospace engineers coming out of Chinese universities every year. And you know, these guys in 10 years' time will be the 30-something you know, design engineers and program managers that are really going to be you know, lifting Chinese industry up the value chain. So yes, you know, Japan, what Japan did with its industry after the Second World War, you know, China are very much going to be there too, moving from a low-cost manufacturer into a, you know, a real sort of powerhouse of design and engineering.
Mm. Finally, just before we go, you've been covering well, the Sukhoi, the Superjet, you know, Russia's, you know, great hope to have, you know, a very strong regional aircraft that could compete with the likes of Bombardier and Embraer. Of course, everyone has also been following that very high profile crash that occurred outside of Jakarta. And now when you look at the order books and I think a lot of raised eyebrows about this, you know, aircraft, this was going to, you know, complete, you know, really reinvent Russian civil aviation. What do you think happens now? And does it almost taint China, though, slightly? Because I'm not saying that everyone sort of throws them in the same basket, but people look at these, you know, well, communist and post-communist economies with slight raised eyebrows about aviation. So even though nothing has happened, you know, in that respect, in terms of test aircraft and high-profile crashes with China, is there nevertheless, you know, perhaps a bit of a negative hangover?
I think there undoubtedly is. I think if you talk to a lot of airlines in the West, there would be a great deal of skepticism about buying a Chinese built airliner, because there's still this doubt that they can make that jump from building basic stuff or building complex stuff to other people's designs and actually moving into high tech engineering and design themselves. But you know, I think they will. If you look at the example of Brazil, Embraer in Brazil, if you'd gone back to the 70s and said that airlines all over the world would be buying a Brazilian built and designed airliners by the 1990s and 2000s, people would have thought you were you were mad. But Embraer have done exactly that. Russia is in a very different position, of course, because they've had an established, you know, their Air Force has just celebrated its centenary. They've had an aircraft industry since before the First World War. So Russia's problem is slightly different. It's sort of reinventing a sort of antiquated and very sort of inefficient industry. China's coming from a very different position. It's really building its industry from scratch. So it's in a very, very different position. And yes, there is a huge amount of skepticism about any new airliner manufacturer coming on the market. But you know, it ultimately, it depends on performance, price, whether people, whether customers believe that the aircraft is safe fundamentally, which is a huge consideration, obviously. And you know, we still have to wait and see with these products. They're not going to be an overnight sensation. It's going to be a slow burn. But you know, I think they probably will. Japan, China, and Russia will get there eventually.
Great. Murdo Morrison, editor of Flight Global, thank you very much for that. Have a great weekend. You are listening to Midori House. We'll be sticking with flying around on Brazilian and Canadian aircraft for the meantime. Jonathan Wheatley is going to be here with the news headlines right after this.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 taget, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 jokes up.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Afternoon to Monocle 24.
The hat at Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House on Monocle 24. In the next half hour, we only have 24 minutes left in this program. I'm going to be talking to author Edward Skidelsky about how long the average employee should be working. And I'll also be joined in the studio by our design editor, Hugo McDonald. He's just back from the Biennale in Venice. And now here's Mr. Jonathan Wheatley with the bottom of the hour headlines.
Thanks very much. Mitt Romney faces a critical test in his White House bid when he addresses the Republican National Convention in Tampa later today. It'll be his biggest television audience to date, as much of the nation will tune in for their first extended look at the 65-year-old former Massachusetts governor who unsuccessfully sought the Republican nomination back in 2008. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has criticized Iran, who are hosting the Non-Aligned Movement Summit today in Tehran, for threatening to destroy Israel and for denying that the Holocaust ever happened. Libya's newly elected National Assembly has suspended three members for having links with former leader Muammar Gaddafi's government, saying that the suspension had resulted from evidence and documents the organisation had found. About 1,000 supporters of the former president of the Maldives, Mohamed Nasheed, have poured into the streets of the capital, Male, today in protest at an internationally backed report which said the leader's removal early this year did not constitute a coup. The Commonwealth-backed report is a blow for Nasheed, who hoped to return to power. And Australia's Finance Minister Penny Wong has today spoken in Moscow about some of the issues the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC, ministers will be addressing at an upcoming summit in Vladivostok. In particular, the summit will be focusing on the Eurozone economic crisis. And those are the stories for the moment on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. Jonathan Wheatley. And we'll have more from you, I believe, at the top of the hour in 23 minutes.
Absolutely.
Very good. Well, you are listening to Midori House, and we're going to ask the question, how much is enough? Because that is what appears on the cover of a new book co-authored by Edward Skidelsky. It's a book that he co-wrote with his father, Robert Skidelsky. And it's probably rather fitting as it's we're examining this book at the end of August, when many of us were supposed to be taking a lot of time off. We can certainly see how August has definitely evolved, and the notion of the whole holiday concept, certainly on this side of the Atlantic, has rather changed, with many of us not taking the month off, or the 3 weeks, or the 2 weeks. Some of us barely getting out of Studio One. Anyway, to tell us more about the book, we are joined on the line by Mr. Skidelsky. Hello.
Hello.
I was in Daunt. I was taking a few moments out over the weekend, and I saw the book, and it landed on our desks, and I thought it was of course a very compelling and intriguing topic, particularly as we're sitting on the doorstep of September. So, tell us about the starting point.
Well, the cue for it was really this little essay by the economist John Maynard Keynes, which he wrote back in 1929. My dad's a big expert on Keynes. In which he made some forecasts about income and working hours. He, in a nutshell, he thought that we in the Western world would by now be 4 to 8 times as rich as we were then. And he was pretty much bang on right about that. But then he predicted that as a result of this, we'd all be working much less. He thought around 15 hours a week or 3 hours a day. And clearly he was wrong about that. We are working less than we were in 1929, but not that much less. It's about 40 hours a week as opposed to 50 hours a week, so nowhere near the 15 hours a week that he predicted. So this really got us thinking about why this could be.
And not to take us to the last chapter, but where do you largely end up?
We think it's very sad that despite this massive increase in productivity we've enjoyed, we're still working almost as hard as we were back then. We think it'd be a good thing if we could take more time off, even if that means some sacrifice of growth. We don't think growth should be the be-all and end-all of economic policy. So we outline some policies for reducing the pressure to work and spend, and nudging us towards the good life, as we put it.
And what does that good life resemble? Earlier in the week, we were looking at the Nordic model, and where fathers can take 9 months off for paternity leave, where moms can be out of work, could be off work for 2 years, yeah. And there's a guarantee of course a job when they go back. Does it look like that, or is it something which is not so state sanctioned, and it might resemble maybe an easier life down in Puglia?
Well, we think leisure is a very important part of the good life, and one that we don't have enough of in most parts of the Western world. I mean, leisure doesn't necessarily mean slacking off, lying by the pool. Leisure can be quite strenuous. It could involve hobbies, intellectual interests. You could even be paid for leisure. If what makes it leisure is not the fact that it's not paid, but it's something you enjoy doing for its own sake and not just to earn a living. A skilled craftsman, we would say, was enjoying leisure even if he gets paid for it.
Mm. So it sounds like part of it is about a shift in values up to a point that one should really be pursuing a career that they love and that that may not end up in a six-figure dollar pound euro salary, but you're saying that it could be half of that or a third of that, but as long as you enjoy what you're doing.
We think people should do more things because they want to do them and less because they feel they have to do them. That's basically the shift we'd like to see.
And do you propose then how we get there? What type of policy changes then have to be implemented by government, or do you get us to a place is it more personal counseling and starting with the individual?
Well, it's a mixture of the two. I think clearly there are lots of things individuals can do or companies can do. Work sharing schemes, which some companies already offer. So rather than rather than trying to squeeze the maximum number of hours out of a small number of employees, they could spread the work more widely, encourage part-time work. But there are things that governments could do to make this easier for individuals and companies. One of the policies we suggest is a unconditional basic income. So this would be an income paid to all adult citizens, regardless of whether they're in work or employment. Quite small at first, but then increasing over time. And this would just make it easier for people to work part-time or, dictate their own hours of work. We also advocate controls on advertising so as to reduce the pressures to consume. And we have a number of other policy suggestions.
And when if you spin the globe, is there any country that's coming close? Do you point us in the direction of a potential benchmark drawn along national lines?
Well, interestingly, the Netherlands and Germany, out of European nations or affluent nations in general, both have some of the lowest working hours and also enjoy a very good standard of living. So it's not necessarily a recipe for poverty, as some of our critics have suggested. In fact, we could be much more productive in work and work fewer hours. That seems to be what's going on in Germany particularly.
Excellent. Edward Skidelsky, author of How Much Is Enough. Thank you very much for that. You are listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
And welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House. Well, for most fans of motor racing, the soundtrack of their sport is the unmistakable roar of Formula One engines. This high-octane, petrol-fueled world has been dominated for generations by the internal combustion engine. But perhaps not for much longer. A brand new championship featuring exclusively electric vehicles has been sanctioned by the sport's governing body, the FIA. Well, joining us for more on that story and what it's going to sound like, or not, in city centres around the world is Doug Peck. He's the editor of eMotorsport News. Hello, Doug.
Hi there, how are you doing?
Very well. I was in Japan, goodness, must be about 2 years ago now, and was actually talking to Nissan at the time, and it was around sort of the build-up to the launch of the Leaf. And even at that time with electric vehicles, there was already this very interesting discussion about, you know, how, you know, the whole idea of what, as we know, sort of Formula One would then sort of take this much more sort of, you know, eco-silent, take it to the streets in a very different format racing concept. Is that where we are now? That there will be new Monacos and there'll be a whole new host of cities that are going to be hosting these races?
Well, that's the idea of Formula E in principle, is to bring sort of environmentally responsible racing to cities that welcome that approach, really. So you sort of mentioned the Nissan Leaf. The idea is that to sort of glamorize electric vehicles a little bit more, because they've suffered from a bit of an image problem of late. So one of the kind of key aims of Formula E is to bring a more exciting form of electric vehicle to the streets and show people exactly what they can do.
And I would imagine that means that they can handle well on hairpin curves, and of course that they can accelerate at a pretty recent clip. And I guess, you know, if that's sort of the starting point for it, you know, is this really one big, you know, marketing exercise, not just for the likes of Nissan, but, you know, all of the other and perhaps more sexier players who are in this territory?
Yeah, it's not just a marketing exercise. It's also a kind of R&D platform. So sort of test out some of the new electric drivetrain solutions that a lot of the big players are sort of working on at the moment. So, and you sort of mentioned the kind of acceleration. I mean, that's one of the major reasons why the electric motors are great for racing, especially around sort of short, tight city circuits, because they sort of develop 100% of their torque at sort of zero RPM. So, as Lorenzo Ferrari once said, horsepower sells cars, but torque wins races. So, it's that's kind of one of the reasons they want to use them on city circuits, because it's not such a high speed racing environment. It's more of an accelerative and cornering ability kind of race.
How much do you think this will also be a branding exercise for cities or countries for that matter? Because, you know, we all know that, you know, Copenhagen has managed to make a name for itself on very strong environmental credentials, that of course it has, you know, very forward thinking, you know, municipality and municipal leaders who have, you know, who of course championed you know, a very strong bicycle culture, for example. Do you think we'll also see an alliance of like-minded cities that will really, I guess, bid for these, because it will not just help push tourism, but it'll also, you know, perhaps, you know, push their political credentials in a different way?
Yeah, very much so. One of the first cities to agree to hold a race is Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, and they've always aimed to improve their credentials in that area. I know there's strong interest also from Monaco, from Mexico, and also in the Middle East and in China as well. So these are not traditionally motorsport grounds. So I think there's a lot of scope to sort of push motorsport into a lot of new areas and bring in a lot more fans, which is always obviously good for the industry itself.
Doug, when we saw the economy take, you know, quite a serious dip 4 years ago, there were a number of high profile departures from Formula One at that time. Do you think we'll see a number of or in a way, does this create an avenue for some of those players to get back into the game?
Yeah, very much so. I think a lot of the traditional sort of sponsors were getting a bit sick of the same old circus, and I think what Formula E does is opens itself up to a brand new audience. That's one of the main aims of it, to bring on younger fans into motor racing. So that obviously opens it up to a newer audience. And that's half the idea, yeah.
Well, great. Doug Peck, we love the idea. Perhaps we'll see you trackside. That was Doug Peck, editor of eMotorsport News here on Midori House. When we come back, our Hugo McDonald is going to be prancing into studio with his report from the Venice Biennale. We're back in a moment.
Aus London, das ist Monaco 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24 horas.
London, então. Eu ganhei o Monaco 24 ainda.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monaco 24.
London, cara, Monaco 24.
De Londres, este es Monaco 24.
And you are back in Studio One here at Midori House. It is just 10 minutes to the top of the hour. You might have heard our Hugh McDonald, our design editor, tiptoeing in his gondolier slippers. We are going to have a brief chat. But before that, we're going to play a song. This is especially for you, Hugh. This is Ciao by Alessandra Amoroso.
Che può sembrare strano, io che ritorno come niente e ti pretendo in un istante. Ciao, sono io. Come stai?
Oh, there's a big finish from Alessandra Amoroso with Ciao. Ciao, Hugo.
Ciao, Tyler.
You are just... I was going to say you're fresh from coming back from the Biennale in Venice, but not quite.
No, you had to land in Stansted.
Yeah, I mean, you went out well, somewhat in style, and coming back to Stansted, coming back via Stansted is never a great thing. We checked in with you throughout the week, and I mean, compared to Biennales of years past, what was your sort of make on it? And because I know you talked about this. In a way, a very blank canvas with this common ground theme that they had. Was it a little bit too woolly, or did it give people? I mean, does it give them enough license to actually do really good things as opposed to painting people into a corner?
David Chipperfield, the director, had a very clear mission that he said over and over again throughout the Biennale, numerous different talks that he gave, that he wanted it to be about architecture and not about architects. And even the big name architects that he brought on board, he tasked them with this theme of common ground and said, I don't want you to bring projects that you've done. I want you to respond to this theme in whatever way you want, but just bring something new.
And did a common theme emerge amongst architects? So, you know, did common ground become... more sort of open, you know, the democratic agora, you know.
I mean, there was a bit of that.
Right.
There was a bit of sort of cross-cultural sort of architecture, different experiences. One of my favourite exhibitions was an Indian architect had brought a lot of Indian construction workers who'd never left India to the Biennale to work with some Venetian students to construct a house in the middle of the Arsenale. And the Indian construction workers were sort of some of the most sought-after interviewees throughout the whole week. And they said, you know, we don't even wear shoes or goggles. And seeing the way that you build and all the red tape that you have to work with here, it's amazing that you can ever build a building.
Mm.
So things like that, you know, came into the fore as well. But on the whole, sort of the consensus was that this is a Biennale really for architects.
Right.
Not so much for people.
And from a nation point of view, for, I mean, if you think of the Giardini, you know, what was the relationship there between, you know, and countries, you know, trying to sort of, you know, push their design and architecture credentials and urbanism credentials versus the architect?
It was very much the latter, actually. People were still bringing out their big gun architects. There were, surprisingly, maybe the Americans were the ones who really put the sort of new generation of architects to the fore. The Danes did a very good job of opening up the discussion about how Greenland can develop.
Mm.
But, I mean, this was sort of old school architecture exhibition, endless infographics on a wall, nothing particularly engaging. If you had 2 hours to read it and go through it, it would be fascinating.
Right.
But, you know, I came away thinking it's an incredible, incredible group of exhibitions. But was it all tied together by this theme of common ground? And do you come away thinking, my God, the architecture industry has really taken a turn for the better? Probably not.
Mm. I don't want to dwell on the negative, but what were the stinkers?
You love a stinker.
I love a stinker.
Oh, you'll be glad to know Russia was a stinker.
Right.
And
Czech Republic was a stinker.
Czech Republic.
Because of their QR codes.
Exactly. But Russia, there was a riot outside the Russian pavilion yesterday, as the Golden Lions were being handed out, the Golden Lions and the prizes, obviously. Mm. The prize ceremony was happening about 50 metres away from the Russian pavilion. And there was a giant protest of Italian students who love to riot, chanting "Free Pussy Riot," and suddenly all these police emerged from everywhere with
batons and everything.
Yeah, it was very dramatic. Suddenly we were all politely clapping for America being given a special mention.
Right.
But yeah, they certainly had their thunder taken away from them.
Did any of your friends in the Balkan nations rush to Russia's aid?
No, they didn't. They were all sitting there looking rather happy.
Having fun in the Kosovo pavilion.
Exactly. But no, I mean, standout people who were there, surprisingly, having just said that I didn't think it should be about big names. Norman Foster had a very interesting installation, which was not about him at all. We've got a little clip. Can you guess what that was?
I'm actually not quite
You're
sure.
You're probably stumped. We should have listened to a bit longer, but I know we're running short of time. But that was all about thinking how architecture creates sound and people. And there were no buildings at all. It was just a series of sounds and images showing how public space ignites emotions in people.
Right. And anything to do with any of his structures? Or
nothing at all. Very selfless of Sir Norman.
Oh, that's very good. At first, there was that roar. I thought it was him taking off in one of his, not one of his, I think he has one Falcon jet.
No.
Well, for all of our listeners who want more of Hugo MacDonald and Tyler Relay, we're going to be doing the Daily next week, right?
Yes, we are.
I think there's nothing wrong with actually doing a plug 4 days in advance.
No, and Section D will be entirely Venice Architecture Biennale themed.
That's fantastic. I've got my own show starting on Saturday. I've got The Stack starting. How's that?
Oh, we can't wait for that.
I know. I've been waiting for my own show forever since our producer, Marcus Hippie, did a land grab and took the menu over for me. He's the producer of today's show. Also, Hannah Jenkins was also involved. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Coming up in a minute and 10 seconds time, we are going to have the news headlines. And also, I believe that Andrew Mulder is going to be here with The Daily a little bit later. That's all. Goodbye.